evening. It is Thursday, July 2nd, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. As we get closer to the July 4th holiday and as the COVID virus is ravaging this country, let me give you the updated numbers. We have 2.74 million people confirmed. That's up by 52,609 from yesterday. We've got 844,000 people fortunately recovered. Unfortunately, 130,000 people have passed. That's up by 670 cases. Just when a lot of people thought that this one was slipping through the cracks, Jeffrey Epstein's ex-girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, was arrested today by the FBI. She faces charges that include transporting a minor for the purpose of criminal sexual activity and conspiring to entice minors to travel to engage in illegal sex acts, as well as perjury. This is according to a 6-count grand jury indictment that was unsealed earlier today. Ms. Maxwell is 58 years old, and as I said, she was arrested earlier today in New Hampshire. What are we to make of this? And are there bigger names that need to be concerned? For insight, we turn to my first guest. He's the author of Sex, Sin, and Subversion, the transformation of 1950s New York's forbidden into America's new normal. He is David Rosen. David, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this conversation.
Thanks to you. First, your thoughts on this arrest, and are you surprised?
Well, I was just waiting for when it was going to happen. This was something that since Epstein's arrest and then eventually his death in December was anticipated. And the question was when. Much of the kind of quote-unquote mystery, at least which the press talked about, was whether she was still in the States, whether she was in Israel, whether she was in Brazil. You know, to me, this was all just show because no one knew. And second, I don't know if you're aware, there was a very, I didn't really watch it, a show, a kind of publicity film put together, a documentary that was on Netflix about Epstein. I don't know if you saw that. In which
no,
got a little buzz, got a little buzz about her. And, you know, it's a very showman, unsubstantiated interviews with neighbors, you know, and a lot of press reports that they just cut and pasted into a documentary. Nothing particularly informative. So the question is, when was the shoe going to fall on her? I mean, it's just a question of time, and it happened yesterday, or today, this morning. What I'm interested in is not so much the fact that she was arrested finally, and the charges that you identified are what, in fact, what's alleged. But what is amazing to me is the fact that she didn't get away. Ironically, I mean, it's sad to say, but both her father, Robert Maxwell, and her former boyfriend, which is Epstein, were both died mysteriously. Both had their own long relationships with Mossad and other intelligence agencies throughout both the United States and the world. And both mysteriously died. And I find that far more intriguing. Why she didn't beat it, why they didn't come. She's obviously not that high value of a target, that she would either be killed or she would be disappeared. And in a good way, she ends up in sort of, you know, pick your spot. That's a glamorous spot that she could get a new name and be someone else.
And a glamorous spot that doesn't have an extradition treaty or
for the States. Yeah.
Right.
Well, no, it's just that, you know, there's a lot one can say about both Epstein and Robert Maxwell, the father, in terms of their roles as entrepreneurs, as sort of fronts for various Mossad financing schemes that went on and spy rings that have been reported upon. I mean, I'm not offering any original ideas here. I just follow what was, to me, these are just interesting players, secondary players in this kind of chess game, which is international politics and how the game is played. And I don't, you know, her role in this seems to be very peripheral to it. She was a glad participant, at least through a certain period of time with Epstein. And now she's got herself caught up in it. What happens? Who knows? We'll see what happens with the trial.
Peripheral to it in some regards, but it seems that if the charges and allegations are now aligning, as in an indictment and her being arrested, the names of others involved might align as well. People such as Alan Dershowitz, people such as former President Clinton, people such as Prince Andrew. These are all names that have come to the surface. And so should those people now start to be a little more concerned?
Hey, I think this is where the game really starts to get more interesting. I mean, you know, it's how long can you deny the truth? I mean, there's all these pictures, there's people giving statements and testimony to the facts. There's all the, you know, I mean, look, there's those photographs of Mr. Clinton on the plane with him. Well, I don't know him. And there's the prince. I don't know him. You know, it's wonderful to watch. It's a hilarious, bad soap opera.
Well, to that point, Alan Dershowitz dares alleged victim Virginia Roberts Guifrey
right.
to make a public accusation, quote, "I challenge Virginia Roberts to come out, look in the camera and say the following words. I accuse Alan Dershowitz of having had sex with me on 6 or 7 occasions," end quote. Should he now be careful what he wishes for?
Hey, let's see when this read. I mean, first of all, one has to sort of withhold just a little twinkle of possibility that, in fact, he's a very virtuous man and none of this happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always that possibility. I personally...
There is always that possibility.
I can't imagine it myself, but... but it's a fun thing to speculate. The question is, who's going to pursue it? Who's going to push this thing really to the end and force these guys out of the closets, if you will, the historic closets of deniability? I have no faith in our Justice Department, particularly under Barr. You don't know what kind of deals are being cut and who and what he's not going to pursue or not pursue. Second, we don't have I personally have no knowledge of what's involved in terms of the international politics of this thing, if there's any at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my feeling is that, you know, at this level, it's going to be simply this Miss Maxwell is going to get hung out to dry. How she plays it, who knows? Maybe she's going to cop a plea, and they'll give her a little hand spanking, and then she'll walk away with a fine and go on with her life. I don't know. We'll see how the game is played. I doubt anything is going to happen with the Clintons or the Prince or Dershowitz. Power doesn't... unless Mr. Trump and Mr. Barr wake up one morning and decide they want to go after all these guys, the Justice Department is going to do nothing. I mean, look, they fired their lead. They had to fire their principal investigator for the New York District because he was asking too many questions.
Right. And what's the probability? And we only have about 40 seconds. What's the probability that this snowball just gains momentum and that this takes on a life of its own?
Well, I think a lot depends on how Miss Maxwell plays it. I mean, I think that she is at this point the missing. She's got the real story to tell.
Got it.
She's got the real story because she's both inside and outside at the same time.
And it depends on the documents that she has to support whatever position she decides to take.
Exactly.
I got to stop you there. David Rosen, as always, thank you so much. I know we'll be talking to you again very soon because obviously
have a good holiday.
You too. This isn't going anywhere anytime soon. Hey, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, as we discussed on Monday and Tuesday and yesterday, the New York Times broke the story Russia secretly offered Afghan militants bounties to kill U.S. troops, intelligence says. As we discussed with Ray McGovern and Dr. Gerald Horn and Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, there are a lot of holes in this story. Now the New York Times is reporting Afghan contractor Rahmatullah Azizi handed out Russian cash to kill Americans, officials say. A small-time businessman, once a lowly drug smuggler, became a key middleman for bounties on coalition troops in Afghanistan, U.S. intelligence reports say. Friends saw him grow rich but didn't know how. Well, what are we to make of this? For insight into this, I'll see your New York Times and raise you my next guest. He's the editor of The Gray Zone and author of several books, including his latest, The Management of Savagery, Max Blumenthal. Max, as always, welcome back.
Good to be back.
So again, I see your New York Times and raise you a Max Blumenthal. Your thoughts on what's going on here. Is this story a plant by the intelligence apparatus? And if so, why?
Well, that's a serious raise, Wilmer. I hope everyone at the table folds because you must be pretty confident, much more confident than a bunch of anonymous spooks who remain the only source in this New York Times piece. In fact, Rukmini Kalimaki, who is this so-called terror expert who is a co-author of this article and writes for the New York Times, who actually did no coverage of terror issues before 2014, revealed in an interview, I think it was on MSNBC with Brian Williams, she referred to the intelligence community as we, and then corrected herself and said intelligence officials, who have been, you know, so sort of a Freudian slip, but they've been the sources on all these pieces. So we, the public, really have no way of verifying. And what's going on here is that since last Friday, so basically almost a week later, these anonymous intelligence officials, basically disinformation agents in the CIA or information warriors in the CIA, just to be fair, have been pumping out this story in drips. It's drip, drip, drip. And it started with just a claim that they believe there were Russian bounties on U.S. troops. And now they finally produced the name, which they already knew they have, of some Afghan figure who is considered the money man behind the bounty scheme, who happens to be in Russia. And that's really all we know. It's the funny thing about this story, it's kind of every one of these stories has a little telltale sign that it might be completely made up, starting with the bounties. I don't see why the Taliban needs, after an 18-year insurgency that has basically ground the U.S. down completely, it's any outside encouragement to kill U.S. soldiers. And if they were getting it, it was through Pakistan's ISI and Saudi Arabia, but mainly through Pakistan. But there wasn't any outrage about the direct, obvious, open funding by Pakistan's intelligence agency. The telltale sign in this story is that there are wires which show payments through the Russian GRU, GRU, the military intelligence agency of Russia, to Azizi, to the Taliban. Now, those are SWIFT wires. How do those wires say Russia's GRU? I don't think so. So there needs to be more details here. And then finally, Wilmer, because, you know, we've finally gotten it some kind of name in this drip-drip information war, which is directed not just against the Taliban or Russia, mainly Russia, but against Donald Trump, is that today the Democrats, the House Democrats, worked alongside the daughter of Dick Cheney, Representative Liz Cheney, to vote for an amendment that basically makes it impossible for the U.S. to withdraw from Afghanistan below 8,000 troops. So it's pretty clear with the timing also of Afghan peace talks coming up in Qatar between the Taliban and the Afghan government supported by the U.S. that this story serves an ulterior purpose. And then we have to question whether it's true or not.
In fact, that takes me to my next question. Before that, let me just say, But Max, they have to remain anonymous in order to protect methods and procedures. They just can't come out and tell us where they got this. I mean, this is the response I get from people when I tell them this story makes no sense. And the first thing you know why it makes no sense is because how terribly sourced it is. Oh, but they have to remain anonymous to protect methods and procedures.
Right. And you know, I accept that from the point of view of a spook. But spooks lie. Spooks lie in the U.S., spooks lie in Iran, spooks lie in Russia. They are trained to lie. And maybe to plant distortions of half-truths where there is a grain of truth, but they're advancing a geopolitical agenda. That's their job. And so I don't fault them for remaining anonymous. Well, who I do fault is the media, specifically the New York Times and the Washington Post. Because when you're dealing with anonymous sources, you have to be extremely careful, and your readers and the public who you're supposed to serve as a journalist deserves more. I didn't need to go to some $80,000 a year journalism school to learn that if some intelligence official comes to me with a story, I have to corroborate it independently and do some shoe leather and find some sources of my own that are independent of people who are paid to lie. And that's the exact opposite of what the New York Times did here. This shows the state of American journalism, which is in the gutter right now. These journalists are essentially stenographers for the intelligence agencies. They basically are printing CIA press releases and delivering it to the public under the banner of a paper that they are indoctrinated to trust.
Without corroboration, independent corroboration, it becomes an echo chamber. And that's exactly what this seems to be, because as you read the New York Times and then you go to the Washington Post and then you go to any other outlet you want to go to, if you're listening to Rachel Maddow, you're hearing the same story being regurgitated based upon the same sources who are unknown. And it really becomes, again, a circular echo chamber. But let me get back to another point that you just made about Liz Cheney and the Democrats. This seems to be one of those narratives where the same story serves both parties for different reasons. Speak to that and to the domestic politics that are involved here.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about the domestic politics, we need to see the political realignment that's taking place in the Trump era, where the center left, the extent that it was left-wing at all in the U.S., has essentially merged with the center-right against the populist far-right that Donald Trump represents. And right now, the Biden campaign has basically outsourced its attacks on Trump. It's essentially outsourced its entire commercial PR messaging campaign to a group of Republican former George W. Bush and John McCain consultants called the Lincoln Project. And all the flashy ads that are racking up viral views on Twitter and YouTube, they're produced by the Lincoln Project, actually by George Conway, who is the husband of former White House Chief of Staff Kellyanne Conway, White House advisor Kellyanne Conway, which is ironic. And behind him is Steve Schmidt, the former campaign manager for John McCain, Rick Wilson, who is a former McCain aide who also was a protege of Lee Atwater, who invented the Southern strategy or honed the Southern strategy. And then you just go on down the line and you see a collection of Republican consultants, and the Democrats are running around praising them. James Carville, the veteran Democratic consultant, Clinton ally, said that the Lincoln Project's actually out there doing things. The Democrats are doing nothing. And that's really true. Biden isn't even campaigning. And all these ads are based on this Russian bounty story. They had an ad ready to go, it seemed like, before the story even came out. It almost seemed like they knew about the story. Hours after the story appeared, there were ads linking Donald Trump to Vladimir Putin and resuscitating the Russiagate narrative that we thought had been discredited with the Mueller report and so many other bombshells that turned out to be duds. And the reason they're linking this story to Trump is because allegedly, Trump did not view a presidential daily briefing that contained information about these supposed Russian bounties. But Trump National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, who's in Trump's National Security Council, has said that Trump wasn't even presented with the PDB. So it's hard to know what to believe. They could have slipped anything in there. But the reason that this story is trafficking is because of the Putin-Trump-Russiagate angle, which is such a good selling point. It's why you didn't hear any outrage about the cover-up by Donald Trump of over 100 U.S. soldiers who suffered traumatic brain injuries at the al-Assad military base in Iraq when Iran retaliated for Trump's assassination of Major General Qasem Soleimani. And it's why you don't hear anyone on the Democratic, within the Democratic fray, talking about removing troops from Afghanistan as the best way to support them. To them, the best way to support the troops now is to escalate against Russia, which seems actually and should seem insane to any rational person. But as I said at the beginning, the Democrats have essentially merged with the neoconservatives and the center-right Republicans against Trump.
And it's also important to understand you don't hear, to your last point about escalation, you don't hear Democrats other than Bernie Sanders and Barbara Lee who are talking about cutting Pentagon budgets. You don't hear Democrats saying the points that you're making, enough of this war. In fact, you've got Biden escalating the dialogue against China, escalating the dialogue against the rhetoric against Russia, escalating the jingoistic dialogue against Venezuela and others. So where one would expect Democrats to be saying, no, enough of this, we need to stop initiating all of this conflict, you don't hear any Democrats taking that position.
No, I mean, you don't hear any major Democrats. You even have...
That's what I mean.
He's supposedly progressive Democrats like Chris Murphy demanding escalation against Russia. Richard Haass, who is a Democrat, who is the chair of the Council on Foreign Relations, is calling for escalation against Russia in Syria. But, you know, after this week, I wonder how much of the Democratic electorate believes that we need to fight them over there in Afghanistan so they don't fight us here, and that them isn't the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, which no longer exist in Afghanistan, but actually Vladimir Putin's Russia. This is the kind of dangerous, mind-altering, hostile narrative that has come to dominate the dawn of the new Cold War that we're in. And if and when Biden gets in office, which is what all the political experts now expect, where will Bernie and all of his delegates and all of the efforts that his supporters may be? Because Bernie has sought to tamp down his supporters' irritation with the Democrats sidelining Bernie one more time and to tell them that they'll have an influence in a Biden White House. Biden made a few moves. His campaign said, we're going to offer jobs to Bernie campaign veterans. But now look at who is really running point for the Biden campaign. It's these neoconservative corporate Republicans. And if Biden is elected after all of this, with the Democratic electorate suffering all of this Cold War, Russiagate brain damage all over again, these Republicans are going to collect and they're going to demand skin in the game when Biden enters the White House. That's another angle to this. And these are people, again, who represented and worked for two of the most warlike figures to ever serve in American politics, George W. Bush and John McCain. So it doesn't bode well for a Biden foreign policy.
You know, if the Russians were paying the Taliban for bounties on American soldiers' heads, doesn't seem as though they got a lot for their money.
Well, it's said that one soldier was killed. The Defense Department says it can't corroborate the story. And, you know, no one can really pinpoint how any American soldiers were killed. We do know that many American soldiers have been killed and maimed and traumatized because the Taliban is fighting a foreign invader. It is a ferocious indigenous resistance group. I do not support their agenda at all. And in fact, as I demonstrated in my book or detailed in my book, The Management of Savagery, the United States, along with its Pakistani ally, played an instrumental role in the creation of the Taliban. But the fact remains, the Taliban is devoted to removing and extricating the U.S. completely from Afghanistan. And Donald Trump entered office with a pledge to withdraw U.S. troops because many people in his base are military families, people who have directly suffered injuries in Afghanistan, casualties, or new people who suffered those casualties. And the American public, and specifically the military families, they want out. They don't know what they're fighting for. They've been there for 18 years, 20 years, 10 years longer than the Soviet Union was in Afghanistan. So where is this all leading to? It's just leading to actually harming the troops even further with the disinformation stories planted in U.S. media. And we haven't even talked about the whole U.S. history of supporting proxies in Afghanistan to kill Russians, or in Syria for that matter. That's the sort of ironic angle to this whole national freakout.
And, you know, to your point about the interesting timing between this story and votes in the Senate, this is from Common Dreams. A bipartisan Senate amendment to withdraw the remaining 8,600 troops from Afghanistan, ending a bloody war, failed yesterday after 16 Democrats joined 44 Republicans in voting to table the measure. What does that say?
Yeah, I mean, it says that this story, which has been bubbling around in intelligence circles apparently since at least January, was planted ahead of that vote. It said it was specifically timed to make sure to box senators in and also to box representatives in. As I said at the top of our interview, there was this House Armed Services Committee amendment jointly sponsored by Jason Crow, the Democrat, and Liz Cheney, the daughter of Halliburton warlord Dick Cheney, prohibiting the expenditure of monies to reduce the number of U.S. troops deployed in Afghanistan below 8,000. It basically makes it impossible. And this follows on the heels of this national freakout over an intelligence plant. So it's very clear what's happening here, as well as the fact that there has just been a breakthrough in Afghan peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. I should mention one more thing. The NDAA, which contains this amendment, also forbids Donald Trump from pulling U.S. troops out of Germany. And they're there to supposedly counter Russia. So it's all about empire, Wilmer. That's what this is all about. And the American public is just having their minds warped to maintain this global police force.
We just have about 2 minutes left. If you could just give a little bit of explanation about, if you understand the relationship between the Taliban and Russia, why this whole theory about Russia putting a bounty on American soldiers would not make any sense.
Well, I mean, it also doesn't make sense because Russia's been extremely supportive of the peace talks. But, you know, the history of the Taliban and Russia is that the Taliban emerged after the Mujahideen, which had supported, but were supported with billions of dollars by the CIA to bleed the Soviet Red Army in Afghanistan, had reduced half of the capital, Kabul, to rubble. And the Taliban came in, actually with U.S. support, to protect the Unocal pipeline to restore order. They had no relationship to Russia at that point. But the irony is, you know, go watch Rambo 3. The original credits read, "This film is dedicated to the brave Mujahideen fighters in Afghanistan." The U.S. was paying bounties, millions and millions of dollars of bounties, to religious extremists to kill Soviet soldiers. So this story really feels like a projection. And it's also what former CIA Director Michael Morell said that the U.S. aimed to do in Syria, pay and arm Islamist proxies to kill Russians and Iranians who are the allies of Assad. Again, just pure projection.
Max Blumenthal, as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your hard work, your analysis, and your phenomenal reporting. And let me say, Max, if I look around the table, I think everybody folded. We're walking away with a pocket full of cash. Thank you, Max. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Wilmer.
You got it, man. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, experts fear July 4th weekend will exacerbate coronavirus spread. Experts worry that the pandemic in the U.S. will worsen after the 4th of July weekend, when millions of people gather across the country during one of the busiest travel periods of the year. The U.S. is reporting record high daily case counts, driven largely by outbreaks in the South and the West. Several states are experiencing more severe outbreaks than they saw 2 months ago. All of this while the U.S. economy added 4.8 million jobs in June, but fierce new headwinds have emerged. What's going on here? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guests. First, she's an assistant professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Dr. Dania Francis. Dania, as always, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
We're also joined by a board-certified pediatrician and obesity medicine specialist. She's on the faculty at the Milken School of Public Health at George Washington University and has a telemedicine practice that is called AskDrYola.com. AskDrYola.com. She is Dr. Yolandra Hancock. Yolandra, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Leon.
So let me start with the U.S. yesterday reported more than 50,000 confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus as states across the nation paused reopening plans due to a recent surge in infections. Dr. Hancock, 50,000 confirmed cases. Your thoughts, please.
I'm not surprised when we see across the country people disregarding the mandates, the requirements for wearing of masks and social distancing. It's not surprising that we see the numbers that we do. It breaks my heart that people have made wearing a mask a political issue, a left versus right issue, an American versus un-American issue. It's a safety issue. It's a health issue and nothing more or less.
Dr. Francis, as an economist, the economy started to reopen and Vice President Pence told us that after Memorial Day, we'd be done with this, that this thing would be behind us. And now here we are coming up on July 4th, and we've got 50,000 confirmed cases in a day. Your thoughts as an economist, what problems do you foresee?
Yeah, I think I agree. I'm not surprised. And I think that it's especially unfortunate, given that one of the reasons behind this push to reopen was to get people back in the job market, to help the economy. But many economists, including myself, are warning that a push to reopen too soon might help momentarily. And we saw that in the most recent unemployment report through June. But in the long term, it might hurt us even more, especially as we see cases skyrocketing and states having to think about pulling back on these reopening efforts.
Dania, let me stay with you on that point. The job numbers came out adding 4.8 million jobs in June, but as I said in the opening, fierce headwinds are right before us, where the Labor Department showed that 1.4 million people filed unemployment claims for the first time last week, as many businesses reversed themselves and closed again during this surge in the virus.
That's right. And I'll do you one more with the numbers. Part of the job increase came from, a large part of the job increase came from the surges in the leisure and hospitality industries. In particular, 2.1 million of that 4.8 million job gains came from those industries. And those are the same industries that are also being linked through bars, restaurants, to higher spread in COVID. So as we see more of those industries being targeted as for shutdown and pause, that 2.1 million gain in those industries and the reverberations in other industries that are sure to come from it might all be sort of eroded.
Dr. Yolandra Hancock, that 50,000 confirmed case number from yesterday represented a new single-day high in the country, which has reported approximately 2.6 million total cases of the virus and 128,000 deaths. I read a story today, Alabama students throwing COVID parties to see who gets infected first. Students in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, have been diagnosed with COVID-19 and have been attending parties in Tuscaloosa and surrounding areas as part of a contest to see who gets the virus first. They put money in a pot, then they try to get the virus, and whoever gets the virus first gets the pot. Help me out here. I don't get it.
I can't help you. I'm a pediatrician, and I'm stunned. I'm just as stunned as you are. This is a perfect example of being stuck on stupid. That's when we know that COVID-19 not only causes infection, but some of the data that we're now observing in terms of the long-term implications of a COVID-19 infection is that there are long-standing impacts, continued fatigue, continued shortness of breath, decreased lung capacity. And we're not talking about people in the ICU, people who've been admitted. We're talking about young people who were at home, had a little touch of the COVID, and then they cannot shake it. We're talking the teens and 20s, not to mention the fact that we are still dealing with this multi-system inflammatory syndrome that we have yet to be able to fully manage. And this is what we're seeing in our young adults. So the fact that they're being so cavalier, one, it speaks to their development because young adults, teenagers, Generation Z, although they're out protesting, they also, from a developmental standpoint, they see themselves as invincible and COVID-19 is not that big of a threat. But as we've talked about before, it's the proximity. If you've lost a loved one to COVID-19, which both of us have, if you have someone who's close to you with a significant COVID-19 infection, you know that it is nothing to play with, nothing to gamble on. And I question the adults in their life and the conversations that they're having in terms of their own protection and the protection of their family members.
Dr. Dania Francis, we were just talking about the economy added 4.8 million jobs in June and talking about the headwinds. And then we just talked about 1.4 million people filing claims for the first time last week. But this marked the 15th straight week of unemployment claims exceeding 1 million, which is a sign, as I can discern, that there is no real recovery for most Americans. And so speak to that. And then also, if you could project, it's going to be, I would say, knowing that the virus takes, the incubation period is 2 weeks. So we're really looking at the 14th, the 15th of July before we understand the impact that folks going out to celebrate the holiday is going to have. I hope I didn't ramble too long there.
No, I think you're right. I think that's an important point. I think the point that you make, there are still tens of millions of Americans who are unemployed and seeking employment. And there's uncertainty also over whether and by how long the government will extend unemployment benefits beyond this current July 31st cutoff. I think that's also going to create economic anxiety that's going to continue to suppress consumption, which, as we know, is a key driver of the U.S. economy. So some of the decisions that we're making at the national level with regard to, stimulus of the economy, protecting workers and families, I think are a little, backwards in our thinking because we're not keeping our eye on the ball that many American households are still in crisis mode. Delaying any aid to households in favor of something like giving it to businesses or other entities really ignores consumers and workers, I think, to the peril of the long-term recovery of the economy.
Staying with you, Dr. Francis, could you quickly, you mentioned a consumer-based economy, and you've mentioned that a couple of times. Dr. Linwood Taheed mentions that quite often. And why the nature of this economy being consumer-based as opposed to being manufacturing-based is such a problem?
Right. It's a problem because, right, so we switched from being a country that makes, more things than we consume to being a country that consumes more things, which means, and much of our employment then does not come from manufacturing and making things and selling things in that regard, but from services. And if people can't be out there getting services, one, because of the worries over the virus, and two, because they don't have disposable income for some of the services that may be considered more luxurious than your sort of meeting your basic needs, that then undermines our ability to grow and sustain our economy.
Dr. Yolandra Hancock, there is another angle here which I really need your clarity on. Researchers debate infecting people on purpose to test coronavirus vaccines. It's a technique called human challenge trial. It has been used to evaluate other vaccines. Help us out in understanding what is the debate here, and is this the time to be having that debate?
So the debate is whether or not this is an appropriate way in which to test the vaccine, and exactly as you described. So you select generally healthy people, vaccinate them, and then purposely expose them to COVID-19 instead of having a controlled phase 3 trial where...
Oh, wait a minute. So you send them to Tuscaloosa, Alabama to a COVID-19 party.
That's exactly what you do. Throw their money in the pot, 50, see what happens.
You put 50 on their head and you see who comes out with the money.
Put 50 on it and see what happens. Exactly. That's exactly what it is. As compared to vaccinating someone and then allowing natural exposure. This has mm-hmm. been done with diseases like typhoid, cholera, and malaria. Where the debate comes in is the fact that we have treatments for something like malaria. They did a similar approach for a malaria vaccine where people who were vaccinated literally stuck their arms in a bucket full of mosquitoes to see whether or not they would acquire malaria. The difference is that if they did acquire it, guess what? We have very reliable treatments for malaria. We still do not have a definitive treatment for COVID-19. And even if we do treat patients, what we also know based on what we just previously talked about is that there are long-term complications resulting from the COVID-19 infection. So if you do not have a clear treatment strategy, if you are still unclear as to the long-term implications of COVID-19, why would you risk otherwise healthy people in terms of facilitating a hastening of the development of the vaccine? As we've talked about over and over again, when the American people perceive scientists, health professionals to skip steps in order to accelerate the development of a vaccine, that's going to further push people to say no.
Let me follow up with you with one more question, talking about pool testing, because over the last couple of days, that technique has been gaining a lot more traction as I've been listening to news reports. And you were very clear that it does have some advantages, but the greatest downside is the high level of false negatives that can come from pool testing. And I don't hear that last point being made as folks have been championing the idea of pool testing. Even Dr. Fauci, I didn't hear him, or maybe they've cut that off, that part off of the interviews that he's doing. But I haven't heard people saying that.
Right. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. If you dilute your reagent in order to increase the volume and you increase the number of tests within that milieu, you're guaranteeing yourself to have some false negative tests. It's just the basics of the science behind the testing. The other concerns that I have that we've talked about before are, one, we've always run short of testing supplies. It hasn't just been a reagent issue. It's been a swab issue. It's also been an issue in terms of being able to isolate. So are these groups of people going to hide out for 3 to 4 days until they have the pooled test result? Are we going to have a system for contact tracing once we identify who the individuals are who are positive? We still have not worked out those issues in order for us to be able to approach this pooled testing strategy.
And quickly coming back to you, Dr. Francis, talking about manufacturing versus consumption. One of the things that we do manufacture are agriculture products. And we've got U.S. farmers scrambling for help as this virus is decimating the immigrant workforce. Can you speak to any ideas that you have on how this is not only going to impact agricultural production, but the economic impact that that's going to have going forward?
I think that's right. One thing that's important to note is that even though a lot of our agriculture has become mechanized, there's still a large labor component to that. One of the arguments that many anti-immigrant groups make is that immigrants are taking jobs away from Americans, especially you think in agriculture. But it's clear that since COVID-19 has restricted the ability of these farm workers to immigrate and work in circumstances where they normally work, their absence has not been filled. It's been hard for farmers to hire enough workers to reach their hiring goals with domestic workers, right? So that's one thing that's clear, even amidst our record levels of unemployment, right? So we have record levels of unemployment, and farmers are still not able to meet their hiring goals to get their crops out of the ground, right? And so I think that this inability to hire and retain domestic workers, even during this pandemic, really shows that these positions are not offering wages that are high enough to suitably, you know, exactly, right? The working conditions, they're not high enough for the working conditions that people are being asked to face, right? So that says something about our agricultural system and how we treat our agricultural workers.
And I'm glad you made that point, because that's been the what the data really shows is it's not that immigrant labor is taking jobs that domestic citizens will do, is that we won't do those jobs at the rates and under the conditions that those jobs are being offered. And one of the perfect examples of that is what is happening in Maryland with the blue crab industry and not having enough immigrant labor to pick and clean the crabs. There aren't enough. There's not enough crab meat going around. Got it. Dr. Dania Francis, Dr. Yolandra Hancock, ladies, thank the both of you for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. Have a wonderful, wonderful holiday. And I know you all are going to practice physical distancing. So thank you all both very much. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is an interesting pattern developing here on video, or at least in my mind. Angry white people are now pulling guns on black people and peaceful black protesters, or calling upon the police to protect them from innocent black people. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's a historical researcher and author of In Search of Purity, Popular Eugenics and Racial Uplift Among New Negroes, 1915 to 1935. And she's also the publisher of Acumen Magazine, Dr. Chantella Sherman. As always, Chantella, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Leon. Always a pleasure to be with you.
So we have this angry exchange. I think this was from yesterday, and accusations of racism caught on video in Michigan, close to Auburn Hills. A white woman bumped into a young black girl going into a Chipotle. The young black girl says to the woman, "We'll excuse you," demanding an apology. This thing then carries out into the parking lot, where as the white woman is backing out from a parking spot, almost hitting this 15-year-old girl and her mother. The mother pounds on the window to say, "Hey, slow your car down." The white woman jumps out with what looked to be a 40 caliber pistol. You've got this white couple in St. Louis as protesters are marching past their house. They come out with what appeared to be an automatic or semi-automatic weapon and handguns. Then, of course, you've got Amy Cooper in New York calling the police on Mr. Christian Cooper, no relation, because he tells her to obey the law and leash her dog. Do you see a pattern here, or am I just making stuff up?
There's definitely a pattern. However, it's not a pattern that's new. And so you'll hear a lot of
what's new is
theology.
The video.
Right. Well, exactly. And what you hear is a lot of people in theology say things like, "There's nothing new under the sun." And that's because there is nothing new under the sun. And what you're starting to see are vestiges of an America that was popular and routine. These actions were very routine up until the 1950s and 1960s in certain areas. And I would say, you know, not to give Texas a bad stroke, but in places like Texas into the 1970s and 80s and 90s. And so what you start to hear also, I believe right around the 1990s, you started to have whiteness studies. And so I think it's imperative as we start to see these types of incidents on screen that you recognize you need to study white people in the way that white people have been studying blackness and all these other groups of people for generations. You need to understand that when white people feel fearful, when they are afraid, violence is the first thing that comes to mind. And what they'll say is, I am protecting myself. It's something that while we say it's violent, it's over the top, it's unnecessary, in their minds, it goes along with patriotism. It goes along with waving that red, white, and blue flag. And so when you start talking about the destruction of things that represent whiteness and control and power, the tearing down of these Confederate statues, Mississippi just took down, you know, the flag because of the, mm-hmm. the Confederate flag that's within it. There are a lot of white people seeing black folks along with white folks marching down streets, and their worst fears are coming to fruition as far as they're concerned. So they're thinking, you know, it's amazing because the woman in the video, this white female in the video that you're talking about, she says over and over again, I am not a racist. Don't mm-hmm. call me a racist. You know, mm-hmm. don't put on me something that may have happened to you from someone else. I'm not a racist. Don't call white people racist if they're not. I believe in what it is that you're doing and da, da, da. I'm not sure where she gets all of this other information, but in her mind, what she's saying is, first of all, when she tells the young girl, you're invading my private space.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a Chipotle. There is no such thing as private space. We bump into each other. And so it lends itself again to this fear, this unimaginable fear that I think a lot of white people kind of embrace where they're not sure what to do. And so violence in the name of protecting yourself. And it's extreme violence. That's what comes to mind. That's the first reaction. That was a conversation, and it could have stayed a conversation. At the same time, there's something, Wilmer, that we don't discuss, which is the erotic life of racism. And there's an amazing book that talks about how a lot of these things that you're talking about, these are white people rushing into black spaces. I'm going to confront a black person. It's almost like you're looking for a confrontation. You're looking for some reason to say something or to be in the same space as this person, but then to control that space. And so that's a type of eroticism that scientists and historians have looked out for years. And there have been books written about it. And it's literally, again, go back and start to decipher the white female that gets on an elevator and screams and hollers that some black man looked at her or she's clenched in the corner trying to figure out if he's going to rape her. And all this man wants to do is get to his floor and get on with his business. What is going on in your mind when you believe that someone is after you, this boogeyman? And the boogeyman comes as boogey women as well. So it's no accident that black women or Latinas or Native people or Jewish women, all of these different people who could potentially destruct or displace whiteness in any particular space, all of a sudden they become a threat to this person's security. And so brandishing weapons and or calling the police seems like a very natural thing for them to do. And that's why you don't see someone get embarrassed by the fact that one white person did this and then says, okay, this isn't something that I will do. Instead, it's a whole train of them doing the exact same thing.
When I watched the situation in St. Louis with the wealthy couple standing in front of their mansion, as people were protesting, walking down the street. Actually, they weren't even protesting. They were protesting them. They were on their way to the mayor's house, who lived on the next block. But what was interesting to me was they live on a private street. And so the first thing that came to my mind when I saw this was, in this whole defund the police movement, what we could very well wind up with are mercenaries being hired to protect people like this in these wealthy private settings. And the other thing that came to mind is this whole idea of the emergence of the castle doctrine and that now being applied to different situations than it was originally planned to where now, to your point, you're able to shoot somebody just because you claim to be in fear of them invading your space, as opposed to what it was originally intended for, which was to protect your property against someone you find who find was not supposed to be in your home.
Exactly. And so literally raise the drawbridge. You didn't even need to come out onto your lawn. Now, if they had breached the security of your property, number one, there's no such thing as private property within that space. So you're on a, they were on a public street. And unless and until they came up on their lawn, then that was still a public space. So the fact that they're yelling, this is private space and da-da-da, no one even crossed or breached their entry. The other thing is that doctrine wasn't supposed to count until that person was not on their property, but inside their home. Again, raise the drawbridge. As soon as they came into your property, if they breached mm-hmm. their doorway, then you had a mm-hmm. right to shoot. All right. But it was like these folks are on a public sidewalk. And so it goes into, again, this whole thing of white people in this country being deputized by the color of their skin. And so from the time we had bounty hunters and militias and slave catchers and all of this, up till we have gated white communities with private security or a one push button to the police. And all you have to say is this person looks suspicious. They don't look like they belong here. This is America. And if it's a public street, I belong wherever I'm standing. But the fact that this is a doctrine that's understood in particular spaces, it opens up, I think, that entire narrative. It opens up that discourse so that the rest of America starts to understand this is how a lot of Black people, a lot of people of color end up arrested for, quote unquote, being in the wrong space. All right. They've not committed any crime, but by the sheer fact that they're in a space where white people believe, I don't believe they belong here because they make me feel uncomfortable. So instead of me drawing my blinds, locking my door, or just going in another space, I'd rather encroach upon their civil rights, call the police, and, you know, say I believe that they're about to commit a crime or that they have committed a crime or they simply don't belong here and actually get them arrested.
Let me jump in real quick. We only have about 45 seconds left. And fortunately, in the instances that we've talked about, no one was harmed. But I see this escalating. I don't see this de-escalating.
Probably not. Unfortunately, we're going to have to learn to get along or perish together. And there are an equal number of videos at this point where white folks have tried this foolishness, and whether they were armed or not, the Black people got on them. All right. And so mm-hmm. one man with a sword, wielding a sword and trying to chase Black people down in order to protect a building, a restaurant that he liked, that he believed would be torn up by Black people, which was never touched. He started chasing Black people down the street, wielding the machete, and instead they took that machete from him, and about 6 or 7 people, mostly white folks with skateboards, beat him up.
I got to stop you there. Dr. Chantella Sherman, as always, thank you so much for your time. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Enjoy the holiday. Please practice physical distancing. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.